it's one of the greatest and most enduring American mysteries. If you come across an article or a podcast about Roanoke, you'll probably run into a statement similar to that one. And odds are you won't question it, because why would you? It feels true. The legend of the Lost Colony has become an integral part of U.S. history and folklore. If you've gone through the American education system, chances are you can rattle off at least the basic plot points. But what if I told you at the time the colonists disappeared, it's likely no one really cared? Probably not even the queen who chartered the trip. So what changed? How did apathy turn into legend? I've talked a lot about how the media shapes public sentiment on this show. Turns out that's been a running theme in missing person cases for centuries. I'm Sarah Turney, and this is Disappearances, a Spotify Studios original. Every Thursday, I'll discuss a new missing person case ripped from history. I want to better understand the many reasons people disappear and the impact their absences can have on those left behind. Today, we're talking about the Roanoke Colony. In the late 16th century, more than 100 English colonists went missing from an island in the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And we still don't know why. Sure, it's become one of the most famous disappearances in American history, but the reason we remember this story may surprise you.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement.
Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
There's a new class of blockbuster drugs. Drugs like Ozempic. They're changing bodies.
And all of a sudden, just the weight starts falling off.
Fortunes.
It just got too expensive.
They're just bank breakers.
And industries.
There was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of skepticism.
The impact of these drugs from business to health is just beginning.
From the journal, Trillion Dollar Shot. Find it in the journal feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so I want you to forget everything you were taught about the lost colony of Roanoke. That way you can have the same experience our team had while we put this episode together. For a mystery that's more than 400 years old, we ran into a lot of surprises. Not just in the story itself, but how it evolved and took on a life of its own. And I'm not talking about wild conspiracy theories like alien abductions, curses, or witchcraft. The mystery of Roanoke is about so much more than what happened to 100-something colonists at the end of the 16th century. But first, let's walk through the story itself, beginning with the day an English explorer and artist named John White set sail for an island off the coast of modern-day North Carolina called Roanoke. It's the spring of 1587. White's hoping to establish the first permanent English colony in North America, aka the New World. Once it's up and running, he'll serve as governor. More than 100 people are joining White on his adventure, mostly middle-class Londoners, hoping to trade their tiny, disease-ridden quarters for a sprawling plot of land in what they've been told is a slice of paradise. It won't be the first expedition of its kind, but it is the first to allow women and children, so they'll be able to plant roots for generations to come. White has some family members coming too, his pregnant daughter Eleanor and her husband, Ananias Dare. Everyone piles onto three boats, headed by a flagship vessel, the Lion. They leave the port on April 26th. and the journey across the Atlantic is, well, a bit of a disaster. I'll spare you the details. Basically, the captain of the Lion is a Portuguese navigator named Simon Fernandez. And even though White is in charge of the expedition, Fernandez calls the shots while they're at sea, which causes some headbutting. The trip's filled with passive-aggressive infighting, fueled by fragile male egos. But the worst part is, one of their ships gets lost along the way, a flyboat carrying most of their supplies, and there's no turning back now. So, after 3 months at sea, the colonists drop anchor off the coast of Roanoke, pretty much unprepared to survive, let alone build a colony. And almost immediately, things get worse. Roanoke isn't supposed to be their final destination. It was just a pit stop. Earlier colonists explored this area and decided it would be better to settle further north near Chesapeake Bay. The water's not as shallow there, easier to access by ship. Besides, a new patch of land up north could give the colonists a fresh start. Relations between past expeditions and the native Algonquin people have been a little touch and go. And that's putting it lightly. It's part of the reason White and his crew are stopping at Roanoke first. 15 men are still stationed there, protecting England's claim to the land. White wants to consult with those guys, learn what's been happening, and then move up to Chesapeake together as a group. But as White and his men climb out of the Lion, Captain Fernandez makes a surprise announcement. He says Roanoke Island will be their last stop. After everyone unloads their supplies, he's headed back to England, to more lucrative opportunities. So if the colonists want to get to Chesapeake Bay, they'll have to find another way. And there's not much the colonists can do about it. So White and his crew row ashore to find those 15 colonists. But all that's waiting for them on the beach are the sun-bleached bones of a single skeleton. It's the worst-case scenario. The colonists are stranded without supplies. Soon they'll be without a ship. And if that skeleton is any indication, they're in danger. Out of options, they get to work rebuilding the fort with what they have. The future's looking bleak. And then, a few days later, a miracle happens. The flyboat that got lost on the trip over, the one carrying most of their stuff, arrives offshore. For the first time in a while, they have hope. But it's fleeting, because the next few weeks are an emotional roller coaster. One of the colonists gets ambushed and killed by a nearby tribe. White and some others retaliate by attacking a village. Eventually, Manteo, a native leader who befriended the first expeditions, comes along and helps smooth things over. The colonists show their appreciation, I guess, by baptizing Manteo as Protestant. He becomes the first native person to convert to Christianity. More milestones quickly follow. On August 18th, just a few weeks after their arrival, John White's daughter Eleanor and her husband welcome a baby girl into the world. Virginia Dare becomes the first English colonist born on American soil, but White doesn't get to spend much time with her. The colonists are in dire straits. They haven't been able to farm, and they're already running low on resources. So, less than 10 days after Virginia's birth, they ask White to sail back to England and speak to their financier, Sir Walter Raleigh. Let him know how desperate their situation is. Simon Fernandez and the Lion haven't left yet. It takes a while to unload the ships and get everything to shore. But true to his word, he's leaving soon. If White doesn't go back with him to get more supplies, the colonists aren't sure they'll survive the winter. White's reluctant to leave his family and sail away on a boat with a guy he hates. But he really doesn't have a choice. Now, almost everything we know about the colonists and their time on Roanoke comes from John White. He kept a journal of their day-to-day activities. So we have this snapshot of all of them in August 1587. Down on their luck, but still making do, welcoming new life into the world, managing personal and political relationships. But once White leaves, there's just a void. This huge void where almost anything could be happening. And it doesn't just last the 6 to 8 months it should take for White's round-trip journey, because by the time he gets back to Europe, a naval war has broken out between England and Spain. The Crown's using all their ships to try and defeat the enormous Spanish armada, so White can't find a reliable ride back. He's stuck there for almost 3 full years. The next snapshot we get of the colonists comes in August 1590, when White finally manages to get back, on his granddaughter's third birthday, no less. And if there were an actual picture, it would be post-apocalyptic. White and a group of men arrive on the island before sunrise. They see a fire up ahead, which they take as a good sign. They call out into the dark and sound a trumpet, but no one responds. There's just silence. When the sun comes up, they reach the settlement and realize the fire must have started spontaneously from heat and humidity. Because the place is a ghost town, there's no one in sight. Most of the buildings have been disassembled, and the only remnants of the 100-something missing colonists seem to be a bunch of scattered and forgotten materials, torn books, broken chests, picture frames soaked from rain. But then, White finds two pieces of evidence that feel important. On a nearby tree, someone carved the letters C-R-O, and on the fort's gate, they carved the word Croatoan. That's it. There are no other signs of life or death. No new footprints, no bodies, no graves. And thanks to an incoming storm, White doesn't have time to investigate further. He and his men have to turn around and head straight back to England, where he lives, haunted by that void until the day he dies. And the mystery of Roanoke has endured ever since. Not really. As I mentioned earlier, at the time, nobody really cared about the missing colonists at Roanoke, not even the Queen. It actually takes centuries for the disappearance to become the great American mystery it is today. And the reason it became popular? Let's just say we've been missing some important context.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
All right, so far, everything I've shared with you is 100% true. I just left out a few details, because that's how I feel the story is most often told, even in schools. Our team actually conducted a little internal poll, and pretty much all of us were taught this spooky story with an almost supernatural ending. Scott Dawson wrote a book on the history of the Lost Colony. He told the New York Times, quote, "In school, you're taught that no one knows what Croatoan means, like it's an eerie, cryptic message. But the truth is, John White knew exactly what it meant. The Croatoans were a nearby native tribe, and they had a lot of face time with all the colonists. In fact, Manteo, the man the colonists baptized right before White left for England, was their leader. And Croatoan wasn't just the name of a tribe, it was also the name of a nearby island. It's called Hatteras Island today, and it's about 50 miles south of Roanoke, which could be important, considering White knew the colonists were prepared to move if their situation got dire. Before he left, they discussed the possibility of them traveling 50 miles into the mainland and setting up camp there. Of course, sailing 50 miles across a bay is different than walking 50 miles west on land. But hey, sometimes plans change. Not only that, before White left for England, they discussed this exact scenario. He and the colonists agreed that if they decided to move while he was gone, they'd carve their destination into a tree or post, and if the colonists thought they were in danger, they'd carve a cross above the word. Now, White didn't find any crosses, which means the colonists probably didn't think they were in trouble. I mean, most of the buildings at the settlement had been taken apart piece by piece, meaning they probably weren't in a rush at the time they left, which could have happened a couple days after White first left, or a couple years. In a journal entry about that day, White said he was greatly joyed that the colonists had made their way to Croatoan, home of Manteo's people, their friends. He was devastated that he couldn't go find his family with the storm, not because he didn't know where to look. Of course, White's hunch could have been wrong. The carvings could have been red herrings. the colonists could have gotten lost or rerouted. Anything could have happened. And in the centuries since they disappeared, countless theories have been proposed, trying to fill in the gaps. My personal favorite theory is that all the colonists turned into trees. If you're interested, there's a treasure trove of wild conspiracies online. But for our purposes, I'm going to stick with the most plausible. Starting with, they all died. It's tragic, yes. But we know the timing of the colonists' disappearance overlapped with the worst drought in over 800 years. They were in a new land with unfamiliar crops, and at any point they could have come in contact with diseases they had no immunity from. And if they didn't die from hunger, sickness, or the elements, it's possible they were killed. Violence had broken out between the colonists and neighboring tribes before. Each side had both been the aggressor and the aggrieved, but the English once set fire to an entire village, murdered a tribal leader, and brought back his head as proof. Tensions easily could have escalated after White left, and there's some evidence suggesting as much. 17 years after John White found those carvings, England finally created a permanent settlement in the New World. It was called Jamestown, and they built it right where the Roanoke colonists wanted to, near Chesapeake Bay. By some 17th century accounts, the chief of an Algonquin empire, a guy named Powhatan, told the leader of Jamestown, John Smith, that he and his tribe slaughtered the Roanoke colonists in a great massacre, and he apparently showed Smith some items they took to prove it. Now, that could put the mystery to rest right there, except historians aren't sure that conversation ever happened. And if it did, it's possible Powhatan exaggerated his account or made it up entirely as a way to scare the latest arrivals. Regardless, native tribes weren't the only threat the colonists faced. Remember, England was at war with Spain, who was also in a race to explore and colonize North America. Most of that war took place at sea, during an era of privateering and pirates. For all we know, a Spanish ship could have landed on Roanoke and raided the colony. The problem is, White didn't find any noticeable signs of a struggle, and if the colonists died or were killed in mass, why hasn't anyone found their graves? Well, that could be because the colonists just moved away, as they discussed, and died somewhere else. Or it could be because they died at sea. When John White left, the colonists were staring down the barrel of a long fall and a cold winter. So some have proposed that at a certain point, the colonists tried to sail back to England as a last resort and possibly ran into bad weather, privateers, or one of the many Spanish ships at war with their country, which is both totally possible and totally impossible to prove. And that just leaves us with the last and arguably most agreed upon theory there is. The colonists survived because they were taken in by one or more of the neighboring tribes. Like, say, the Croatoans. Around the same time that John Smith was talking to Powhatan, rumors were flying around Jamestown about people living in the area who dressed in European-style clothing. Smith sent multiple parties to investigate, and though they didn't find the people they were looking for, they did apparently find crosses carved into trees, which they took as a sign that Christians were alive and well in the area. Now, despite Manteo's baptism, in their mind, that meant Europeans. It's also worth mentioning that researchers and archaeologists have found European and indigenous artifacts mixed together in local sites dating back to this period. And as early as 1709, historians cited the appearance of gray eyes in native populations as proof that some of their ancestors must have been white. Now, I could go on and on. You can argue most of these theories from every angle. Any or all of them could be true. Maybe the Roanoke colonists split up. Some died, some got killed, some moved, some had to be quarantined. One group moved west, another south. We'll probably never know. I said earlier that it took a while for the story of Roanoke to take root, and that's true. It took more than 200 years. In the immediate aftermath, there were rumors and speculation. But for the most part, you could say that people didn't really give it much thought, including the queen herself. And honestly, that makes sense. The crown knew these expeditions were high-risk investments. Roanoke wasn't their first or last failed attempt at establishing a colony. I mean, we barely talk about the 15 men who were supposed to be there when the colonists arrived, probably because we've always accepted that they were killed. So why are we still talking about the lost colony of Roanoke? Well, turns out we have an answer to that question, and it's as unsettling as people turning into trees. According to journalist Andrew Lawler, the story of the lost colony was first popularized in 1834 when a man named George Bancroft wrote a book called History of the United States: From the Discovery of the American Continent. Intentionally or not, that book changed the course and cultural relevance of Roanoke. It went from being this forgotten blip in history to American folklore, one that would eventually have people hailing John White's granddaughter, Virginia Dare, as the, quote, infant child of pure Caucasian blood, who launched the birth of the white race in the Western Hemisphere. In 1834, historian George Bancroft writes a popular book that presents the Roanoke colonists as the beginning of U.S. history. Sure, the United States didn't exist at that time. The colonists failed at their goal, and most of them probably died. But to Bancroft, they're the embodiment of the American spirit. Brave pioneers who abandoned the old world and risked their lives to lay the foundation for democracy and freedom in the new. The section on Roanoke is short, only a few pages, but Bancroft chooses to highlight the birth of John White's granddaughter, Virginia Dare, quote, the first offspring of English parents on the soil of the United States. From there, American writers latch onto this idea of Virginia Dare, the original American heroine. They publish fictional tales about the disappearance of the Roanoke colonists, with Virginia as their protagonist. The first, which was written by Eliza Cushing, coins the term the lost colony. The story goes something like this. In the fall of 1587, John White sails away from the colonists, and in his absence, they're viciously attacked by a villainous native tribe. The colonists fight bravely, but they're outnumbered. To save their lives, a friendly chief from a different tribe leads them away to a secret, hidden paradise in the woods. The colonists and natives live there, together, in harmony for a while. But in time, most of the colonists die, except one, Virginia. She learns the ways of the wilderness and blossoms into a nymph-like hunter with a bow and arrow, who's equal parts Katniss Everdeen and the Virgin Madonna. She converts the entire tribe to Christianity and is adored by all. The native men all throw themselves at her, but she dodges their advances and ends up falling for a white colonist from Jamestown, who somehow stumbles into the picture and then dies from disease before the end. Virginia spends her last days heartbroken and alone. The native people remember her forever as the White Angel of Mercy, who changed their lives forever. Now, to reiterate, we don't actually know anything about Virginia Dare or her life, apart from her birthday and her name, which were written down in a logbook back in 1587. We don't know if she lived out the rest of the year. But after Eliza Cushing publishes her version of the folktale, Cornelia Tuthill writes her own. That's followed by another and another. Stories and poems about Virginia Dare's fictional experience in the New World continue well onto the 20th century, and they all follow the same general plot, although in some, Virginia magically turns into a white doe at the end. In no small way, she becomes the face of the lost colony and further solidifies Roanoke's place in American history, but not as a mystery, as a heroic, romantic tragedy. Author Robert D. Arner and journalist Andrew Lawler have written books about Roanoke, and they believe the popularity of the Virginia Dare legend says a lot about what Americans at the time wanted to believe, that the Roanoke colonists were valiant underdogs who battled evil, saved souls, and were meant to be worshipped. Most importantly, that Virginia Dare knew the forest better than anyone, like she was born for it, like the land was meant for her. And that's a very American concept. You might have heard of Manifest Destiny, a myth that was famously spread by President Andrew Jackson, who was actually in the Oval Office when George Bancroft wrote that book. It's the idea that America's expansion into the West at the expense and genocide of Native people was justified, preordained, and inevitable. Lawler and others have argued that Virginia Dare did more than just sell the lie of manifest destiny. She also set the stage for the lost cause of mythology of the American Civil War. By 1907, Virginia Dare literally became a symbol for white supremacy and nationalism. The irony being, if the real Virginia lived long enough to have children, they probably weren't white. Then, in 1937, another famous interpretation of the Roanoke legend was born, a musical play called The Lost Colony, written by Paul Green. Franklin Delano Roosevelt attended the production on Roanoke Island that summer, and the show's been performed there every year since, with the exception of 2020 due to COVID. Native characters were played by white actors wearing grease paint until 2019, and the themes of manifest destiny are just as present today as they were back then. Which is all to say, maybe America's fascination with Roanoke has very little to do with what happened to the colonists. Maybe we've only kept the mystery alive because we don't want to accept the much more likely truth. That the colonists were unprepared to survive in the New World, and if they did, it was only by the grace of the native people, whose religion our ancestors scoffed at, and whose land they came to steal. Researching this story made our team think a lot about how history is about perspectives, the ones we have access to, and the ones we listen to. We have the power to tell the story of Roanoke another way, from the perspective of those who were definitely left behind after the colonists disappeared. That's the story I want to leave you with today. When John White and the colonists land on Roanoke, they're not the first Europeans to arrive in North America. Explorers from Spain, France, and more have landed in the Caribbean, in Canada, Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Arizona, New Mexico, and the Carolinas, to devastating ends. By 1587, an estimated 90% of native populations they've come in contact with have already died from the diseases the colonists brought over. In Haiti, the Spanish military has slaughtered 250,000 Arawaks. Many have chosen to poison their children and die by suicide to avoid capture. Elsewhere, all across the continent, Native women and children are being captured and sold into slavery. There's been massacres, genocides, and rebellions. The Roanoke colonists settle in an area inhabited by the Algonquin people, who, archaeological evidence suggests, have been living there for more than 800 years. At the time, there are anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 Algonquins there, belonging to different tribes and sub-tribes that share the same language. They live in villages with town centers for business, trading, and ceremony. They have their own political alliances and rivalries, which have become more complicated since the arrival of the first English colonists 4 years ago. As a result, violence has broken out. Even still, tribes like the Croatoans show kindness by sharing knowledge, tools, and food, and possibly by taking the colonists in when they have nowhere else to turn, not knowing it would be a death sentence. By Jamestown's founding in 1607, the majority of the Algonquins have died from foreign diseases or have been driven out of the region. By 1622, English colonists have massacred the Powhatan people, killed their chief, and are engaged in an all-out war. John Smith likes the idea of the Native Rebellion because it will give them, quote, just cause to destroy them by all means possible. In 1623, colonists in Massachusetts invite multiple chiefs and their people to a meeting, which they say will be for peaceful negotiations, and execute them all. More than 200 Powhatans in Virginia are poisoned and killed soon after. In 1641, the Dutch governor of New York makes it legal for colonial men to rape and enslave any Native woman or child, and he begins offering cash rewards for Native scalps. Official campaigns are launched to support the extermination. A list of massacres goes on and on. Between the arrival of the first Europeans and the year 1650, scholars estimate that Native populations in North America dropped by as much as 106 million, more than the current populations of England and Spain combined. In the 1700s, native slave trade becomes America's biggest business, and the bloodshed continues. Ben Franklin proposes using alcohol as a way to eliminate native populations. The British start intentionally infecting tribes with smallpox. Thomas Jefferson advocates for the forced relocation of the Cherokee and Shawnee tribes and the extermination of all native people. And by the time the American Revolutionary War ends, huge swaths of tribal lands are forcibly seized, regardless of any prior agreements or treaties protecting them. In the 1800s, Manifest Destiny basically becomes the official justification for all of this. Andrew Jackson authorizes the Indian Removal Act, allowing the U.S. military to forcibly remove Native people from their lands. It paves the way for the Trail of Tears, where by 1850, more than 46,000 are ripped from their homes and marched to a newly created so-called Indian Territory. As Virginia Dare becomes an American literary hero, Americans continue to commit countless massacres against Native people. I can't stress enough how common these atrocities are. In 1862, the U.S. military promises the Dakota people that if they surrender peacefully and give up their land, their lives will be spared. But after they surrender, hundreds are arrested, stripped of due diligence, and sentenced to die. One day after Christmas, President Lincoln personally orders the execution of 38 Dakota men, who hold each other's shackled hands and sing death songs while crowds of white Americans cheer for them to be hanged. In 1879, President Grant institutes a new boarding school policy, which rips Native children away from their families and sends them to white schools. The idea is to, and I'm using air quotes here, civilize them. These assimilation policies will continue well into the 20th century, but before the end of the 1800s, American politicians will make it illegal for some Native people to practice their faith and to dance. Crimes punishable by up to 6 months in prison. In 1938, 1 year after Paul Green's musical drama The Lost Colony premieres on Roanoke Island, Congress passes the Indian Lands Mining Act, which hands the U.S. government the power to mine Native land. After World War II begins, the United States requires all Native men to enlist in the draft, and as they serve a country that hasn't ever served their interests, American mining companies start blasting millions of tons of uranium on Navajo land, which the government then uses to make nuclear weapons. In 1953, Congress begins passing termination policies that allows legislators to disband tribes and sell Native land. The Supreme Court rules that, quote, "Nothing else that Congress can do could cause tribal members to lose more of their rights than termination." But that doesn't stop it from happening to countless tribes over the next 9 years. By the end of the 20th century, Native people in America have won the right to self-govern and self-determine their futures. But the federal government somehow misplaces the $2.4 billion owed to them. And the nuclear test, oil drilling, and fracking continues on protected land into the 21st century. Now, I've only included a small fraction of how and why this continent's first settlers have disappeared over the centuries. Honestly, it was overwhelming and humbling to research. The sheer amount of tragedy and injustice that was missing from my school textbooks growing up. As of this recording, Virginia Dare's name is still being used by hate groups. The Indian Child Welfare Act that was passed in 1978 to help ensure Native children aren't taken from their tribal communities without just cause is in danger of being overturned by the Supreme Court. Native people in the United States, especially women and children, experience violence at a rate that far exceeds national averages. Though they're less likely to be federally reported, they also make up a significant portion of all missing person cases in the U.S. Of course, Native people have always been much more than victims. They've resisted, fought, and negotiated for rights that are supposed to be inalienable. But change can only ever come when we look past the legend and listen. Thank you for listening. In the time it took you to finish this episode, 30 people disappeared in the United States alone. Among the many sources we used to create this episode, we found Dr. Karina Walter's research on North American history through a Native lens extremely helpful. You can read more at nativephilanthropy.candid.org. You can also visit Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA at mmiwusa.org. Again, that's mmiwusa.org. MMIW is a nonprofit organization whose number one mission is to bring the missing home, help families of the murdered cope, and support them through the process of grief. You can find all episodes of Disappearances and all other Spotify Studios originals for free on Spotify. Disappearances is a Spotify Studios original. Our head of programming is Julian Boireau. Our supervising sound designer is Russell Nash, with Nick Johnson as our head of production, and Spencer Howard as our post-production supervisor. Allie Wicker is our supervising editor, and Derek Jennings is our writing lead. This episode of Disappearances was written by Connor Sampson, edited by Natalie Pertzofsky and Aaron Lan, fact-checked by Kevin Johnson, researched by Brian Petrus, produced by Aaron Larson, with sound design by Alex Button. I'm your host, Sarah Turney. To hear more stories hosted by me, check out my other podcast, Voices for Justice.